Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Science holds a unique place in modern thought. We rely on it to describe the world and to reveal reality. And because we use it to give credence to our ideas, we occasionally misuse it, either to deliberately deceive or due to unintentional biases. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. So who decides what science is and what it means? Scientists themselves play a major role in this, of course, but so do philosophers, who wrestle with the line between the objective pursuit of knowledge about the natural world and what could be best termed pseudoscience, and encourage all of us to think carefully about the potential and limitations of science in pursuit of universal truth. Tim Lewins is professor of philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Clare College. His new book is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. Tim, welcome to Think.
Hi, it's really great to be here.
There are so many things we can learn from science. Ironically, science cannot tell us the meaning of science.
Well, that's right. And that's because there are so many questions about how we should interpret science. There are questions about whether science is in the business of telling us fundamental truths about the universe, or whether it just gives us a series of useful tools that help us calculate what's going to happen in the observable realm. There are also a bunch of questions about what the real significance is of science. Can science tell us about human nature? Can it tell us whether we're fundamentally good or fundamentally bad? Can science tell us whether we have some kind of profound form of freedom? All of those questions concern how to interpret the results of science, and that's often where philosophy comes in, and that's why I don't think that science can do these jobs of interpretation all by itself.
You trace the philosophy of science back to the ancient Greeks, which is remarkable because I'm wondering how they tackled these questions before science in the modern sense even existed.
Well, people have always been interested in questions about, for example, the nature of biology, questions about whether or not there's some kind of special feature of organic organization, for example, that means that the sorts of explanatory tools that we might use for explaining simple material events, how simple physical objects move, whether those could be translated into an explanation of animals, their birth, their reproduction, for example. So people have always been interested in questions about the diversity of the world, questions about whether the same scientific tools are going to be useful for approaching all elements of the world and so forth. Of course, now we have a lot of very kind of modern questions specific to today's sciences, questions about evolutionary theory, for example, which the Greeks were not in a good position to formulate, obviously. But there's always been profound reflection on the nature and organization of human knowledge. And in that sense, philosophy of science has existed for thousands of years.
Why have some people, and one example that you give is the physicist Richard Feynman, why have some people assumed that science and philosophy were incompatible, that they really had very little to do with one another?
Well, I think sometimes it's a straightforward question of turf war. And sometimes, of course, I think the worry is that, you know, maybe we philosophers are in the business of casting doubt on science or undermining science. And if that's what one thinks the philosophy of science is about, then, of course, it wouldn't be surprising if scientists turn out not to like it very much. That's absolutely not what the philosophy of science is in the business of doing. Philosophers of science, pretty much without exception, have extraordinary respect for the results of science. The question is more how to set those results in a broader framework. In the case of Feynman, one of his worries about philosophy of science, rather, was simply that he didn't see good evidence that philosophers of science could help make scientists better at their jobs. Now, let's set aside the question of whether he was right about that. Even if he was right about that, of course, it doesn't show that philosophy of science is useless. It may well be that philosophy of science has a lot of practical impact, showing how it is that scientific advice should feed into deliberative processes about new technologies, for example, and more broadly, what the general status of scientific knowledge is, even if we can't help scientists do their jobs better. Now, having said that, I also think Feynman was somewhat mistaken. I think that there's a lot of really healthy collaboration that goes on, an actual mutual instruction between scientists and philosophers of science over the proper interpretation of particular bits of scientific theory. It's maybe also worth saying that we shouldn't take Feynman to be representative of scientists. So Feynman, as I've said, didn't really think that much of philosophy of science, but there are very, very significant scientists. Albert Einstein, for example, whose stature is at least as great and probably greater than Feynman's. And Einstein really thought that philosophy of science was an extremely valuable enterprise, so we shouldn't put too much weight on Feynman's views.
You share a story in the book of a physics professor, not Feynman, who wrote to Einstein for advice. Should I include philosophy in my curriculum?
Yeah, that's right. And Einstein wrote back and he said, absolutely yes. And you shouldn't just include philosophy of science, you should include the history of science as well. Einstein basically had this view that a scientist who proceeded without reflecting on the history of the subject and without reflecting on philosophy could be a little bit like someone who can't see the wood for the trees. They become focused on their own narrow specialization, and they don't stop to think about how the scientific endeavor got to regard that question as the most fundamental one, when maybe science could have gone in other directions. And they also don't stop to think about the broader meaning and significance of what it is that they're doing.
How do we decide, Tim, where science begins and ends? Why, for example, is chemistry unquestionably a science when something like economics, which uses data and observations and mathematics to analyze and predict behavior, why is that arguably something other than science?
Yeah, so there are a lot of these controversies about which endeavors are bona fide sciences and which aren't. So economics is one good example. There are many others. There's, of course, a lot of controversy, as you know, about the teaching of creationism and various forms of intelligent design theory. There's also a lot of controversy about things like homeopathic medicines. My view is that it's very hard to find a kind of one-size-fits-all tool for deciding whether something's a science or not. I think instead we often need to go through things on a case-by-case basis. And actually, even within particular branches of learning, often the answer that you need to come up with, it's not just a simple yes or no issue. So the case of economics is an interesting one there. So there are some economists who I think have as good a claim to being bona fide scientists as anybody else does. They often pay a lot of attention to how real people think and behave. They go out and they do experiments. They put people in laboratories. They pay a lot of attention to data. Now, there are other kinds of economists who are much more interested in formulating kind of fact-free abstract models which look at how largely imaginary people would behave if they had perfect information and if they were perfectly rational. And they go on and show what markets would do under those circumstances. And some of those economists are surprisingly blasé when it comes to finding out how real people do things, how real people think and behave. And I think it's quite a lot harder to think of that kind of endeavor as science compared with other branches of economics, which I think are really kind of squarely fall within the sciences.
How have the ideas of Karl Popper shaped our understanding of what science is and what it can and cannot do for us?
Okay, so Karl Popper is an Austrian philosopher of science who then moved to Britain later in his life. He's been extraordinarily influential. I think it's probably still the case now that if you ask a scientist to say what the scientific method is, and if you ask a scientist one of those questions about how to tell the difference between real science and pseudoscience, they'll usually refer you to the pronouncements of Karl Popper. So Popper's someone who's had a massive influence. He was a philosopher, but he was a philosopher who's extraordinarily respected by scientists. And roughly speaking, and we can talk about this a bit more if you'd like, roughly speaking, Popper's view is that genuine science sticks its neck out. It exposes itself to various rigorous kinds of tests. And that's why Popper thinks that astrology is not a real science, whereas astronomy is a real science. Because astronomy, Popper says, tells us this is when we're going to expect the comet to arrive. And if the comet doesn't arrive, so much the worse for the theory. Astrology, on the other hand, those newspaper astrology columns that we read, its claims are often couched in these extraordinarily vague terms. So it might say something like, disappointment may greet you next week. Now, of course, disappointment may greet you next week. The chances are at some stage during the week, something will happen that you're not particularly happy about. But Popper's thought is that these claims are always phrased in such incredibly vague ways that the theory never really sticks its neck out properly as to what's going to happen or what's not going to happen. And because of that, it's not really ever vulnerable to experimental test. So real science always makes firm commitments, Popper says, about what we should expect to see. And because of that, it boldly exposes itself to the tribunal of experience, whereas pseudoscience always runs away from that kind of test.
My guest, Tim Lewins, he's professor of philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Clare College. His new book is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. We'll come back to our conversation with him in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Professor of Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge, Tim Lewins. He's also a fellow of Clare College and author of the new book, The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tim, I'm glad we have you back with us.
Yeah, I seem to be back with you. Who knows what happened there, but it's nice to be back with you again.
Well, before the break, I was asking about Sigmund Freud, and I mentioned that in reading for a different show, although you mentioned Freud briefly in your book as well, the idea was that, you know, Freud did not like to have his ideas questioned. He made observations, he came up with theories, but he didn't want anyone else to come back in and test them or, you know, check to see if this applied to a variety of different patients. Is he conclusively not a scientist?
I wouldn't like to say that. I mean, he certainly fell into Popper's list of enemies. Popper had a very strong intuitive view that Einstein and Newton were real serious scientists. He really didn't much like Freud's psychoanalytic views. He also didn't much like Karl Marx's theory of history. There were various other theories that fell into his kind of box of bad theories. Now, there are some pronouncements that Freud makes which I think kind of allow you to see why it was that Popper didn't think that much of Freud. So I was saying that for Popper, a piece of pseudoscience is something that runs away from empirical test. Now, there's a nice story that Freud himself recounts, actually, that seems to really cast Freud in a bad light as someone who ran away from serious efforts at refutation. So Popper had this theory of wish fulfillment. The idea goes that in our dreams we dream things that show our deepest desires being fulfilled. And then he says that he had a patient who came to see him. And she said to him, well, what about this dream? This isn't some deep desire that I wanted to be fulfilled. I had a dream that I went on holiday with my mother-in-law. And she says, I hate my mother-in-law. Going on holiday, she says, going on holiday with my mother-in-law is the last thing in the world that I'd want to do. So this is just a refutation of your view. There's just no way that this is me dreaming my deepest desire. And what Freud says, which looks like a kind of an extraordinary contortion, Freud says, well, what this shows, of course, is that her deepest desire was to refute my own theory. And so that's why she had this dream. And so Freud turns this apparent refutation into a triumphant confirmation of his theory. But of course, the worry is always that this is really just a terribly kind of elastic feature of his theory that isn't really a good thing at all. If Freud's able to kind of cook up explanations like that, then it really doesn't cast Freud in such a great light after all. So I certainly think there are reasons to be doubtful about Freud's status. At the same time, though, Freud is hardly unique here. Freud is not the only person who tries to find ways of showing that what might seem like bad news for a theory isn't really such bad news after all. And it turns out there are lots of scientists who fall on the good side of efforts to sort science and pseudoscience who also do things like this. So Charles Darwin, for example. Darwin says, well, you know, if my theory is true, if my theory of evolution is true, then it should turn out that we'll find loads and loads of fossil remains of previously existing organisms whose forms are kind of halfway between all of the organisms that we see around the world now. Because after all, my view says that all the organisms we see now are kind of gradual modifications of earlier ancestors. And then various people say, but the problem is, Charles, there is no such fossil evidence. We haven't found it. And then Darwin does something that, again, superficially might seem like one of these kind of rather elastic moves. He says, well, yeah, there would have been fossils like that. It's just that fossil remains are so hard to preserve. And that's why it is that we don't see these fossils around. It just turns out that the geological record is just too imperfect. It turns out that it's too rare for the right kinds of fossils to be preserved. So there were indeed all of these forms. It's just that we can't find the evidence for them. Now, there are a lot of features like that of science where scientists make these kinds of moves that preserve their theories from what look like uncomfortable evidential consequences. And I think it's very, very difficult to use that as a straightforward criterion of good science versus bad. Partly because often you can't tell at the time. I mean, now we've found loads and loads of these intermediate forms. It turns out that Darwin was right about this. But Darwin wasn't really in a position to know that for sure at the time. So it's very, very difficult to apply these kinds of criteria prospectively. We can look back and sort the wheat from the chaff, but it's very hard to do it looking forward.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Terry in Arlington. Hi, Terry.
Yes, Professor Levin, I'm not so sure about your characterization of Karl Popper. He's, of course, a great figure in the history and science, but you say he has a standard of science as being something of willingness to stick its neck out. The stick-out negativeness, I'd like to know where you find that in Karl Popper's works. It seems to me there are two standards very clear by Karl Popper, and that is, one, falsifiability, two, predictability. And you give a good example of this in the case of predicting the position of a star. In the case of not so clear science like economics, there you look at the Wharton School, which bases its predictability on mathematical models, and you say, no, economics is not a science because it can't predict based on these mathematical models.
All right, what do you think about that, Tim?
Okay, so I think you're right, of course, that Popper's primary criterion for whether something is a science or not is this notion of falsifiability. Now, I mean, I phrase this in terms of a theory sticking its neck out, and I think that's a reasonable way of putting it, because for Popper to say that a theory is falsifiable is to say that the theory very explicitly states what would need to be discovered for that theory to be viewed as false. So for Popper, it's a good thing if a scientific theory makes very clear what's going to count as bad news for that theory. And if a scientific theory instead is very slippery as far as what's really going to count as bad news for the theory, then Popper says it's not real science. And so that's all I mean when I say that for Popper, scientific status is a matter of whether or not the theory's really, really sticking its neck out or not. Now, as far as economics goes, there's no sin in using mathematical models, and there are plenty of sciences that do that. Biology, for example, is a science that often makes use of mathematical models. It's also true that there are many sciences that are fairly poor at predictions. So I don't think we can merely use kind of failures of prediction to show that economics isn't a genuine science. My worry instead is that often the kinds of models that economists use really don't pay very much attention at all, even to basic psychological tendencies that humans have, whether or not those are then put to work in mathematical models or not.
What is scientific realism?
Okay, so this goes back to something that I think I was mentioning right at the beginning. Pretty much all philosophers of science have a very respectful attitude towards scientific theories. They think that science has usually made significant amounts of progress, has helped us to understand the world. Now, the question, though, is how we should think of the status of scientific theories. So scientific realists think that in some way or another, science is in the truth business. So scientific realists think that science is capable of and has generally succeeded in getting closer and closer to the truth. Now, you might think that's an obviously correct view, but it turns out to be surprisingly hard to argue for, and it also turns out there are other alternative views. So one alternative view goes like this. No, science isn't in the business of finding out fundamental truths. Science is just in the business of prediction. It's in the business of predicting what's going to happen at the observable level. And a theory can succeed in predicting what happens at the observable level, even if it's way off the mark as far as what goes on at the microscopic, unobservable level. And so those kinds of folk called scientific anti-realists tend to think that it's anybody's guess as to whether or not science is really getting at the truth. Instead, we should just say that science consists in something like a bunch of really, really useful tools.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones and speak with Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi, very good subject. I've done some study in this, and this is my view. I believe that science is in the business of trying to find out the truth of reality. And one of the reasons I believe it's so respected is it does have a modesty in that agrees that should any facts emerge that contradict it, it will change its position. So I believe that truth should always be assigned a probability, that we're 100% or 10% or whatever percent sure of a particular fact we state or an assertion of truth. Now, the real issue to me is, what is the distinction between science and philosophy? And in my view, I believe that science helps us describe the world, understand the world. It helps us understand the truth of reality. But philosophy, science is silent on what philosophy addresses, and that is, what do we do with it?
What do you think, Tim?
Okay, yeah, thanks very much. There's an awful lot in there, and I think I have a great deal of sympathy with a lot of the points that you're making there. The scientific realist position, which we've been talking about, is one that's kind of tricky to formulate. So I said that according to the scientific realist, science is in the truth business. Now, I think something that you're already getting at there is that, of course, it would be crazy for anybody to say that science has already found all of the truths that there are. It would be crazy for anybody to say that there's nothing more left to know and that there's no chance that we'll ever revise any of our scientific knowledge. So, of course, whatever position scientific realism is supposed to be, it had better not be the view that science is finished, right? There's clearly plenty of work left to do. And, of course, it's a commonplace among pretty much everybody who's involved in these debates to stress that science is a fallible enterprise. I guess one of the interesting challenges for the scientific realist, though, comes from the ways in which even many of our most cherished theories have been viewed for many, many years, tens of years, in some cases even hundreds of years, as being correct. And then along comes some new theorist and says, do you know what? We need to completely tear that view up. So Newton's views about the universe get replaced by Einstein's views, for example. Views that regard species as fixed over time instead get replaced by these Darwinian views. So one of the challenges to scientific realism goes roughly like this. And I think it's a challenge that can be met, but the challenge roughly goes like this. It's fair enough for the scientific realist to say that science increasingly approximates towards the truth, but how are we supposed to square that with the historical record? Because it looks as though what happens is that time and time again, our most cherished theories are ripped up and replaced by very, very different theories. And just extrapolating from that historical record, the argument goes, we should think that something similar is going to happen to the theories that we have right now. So, of course, the theories we have are useful, but the chances are that in the future they'll be replaced by something really, really different. Now, that kind of argument is, I think, one that the scientific realist needs to rebut, because yes, the scientific realist wants to say that science is a fallible enterprise, but it also involves this increasing approximation on the way that things are. So the scientific realist also needs to show some kind of continuity over time.
Can we ever definitively say that science is settled, that we have concluded our inquiry into something?
No, I mean, I think that there are always going to be revisions. There are always going to be revisions and refinements. And you see that even with elements of scientific theory that are very, very well understood and very, very widely accepted. So the basics of the Darwinian theory of evolution by natural selection, for example, are so widely accepted as to really be, I think, beyond reasonable doubt. But nonetheless, there are always various quibbles, various ways of fiddling around with these theories, worries about whether or not we should think of evolution as forming a tree-like structure in the way that Darwin thought, or whether instead bits of the evolutionary tree might actually involve fusing of branches again, meeting up with each other later on in time, for example, as various kinds of fancy forms of genetic exchange that Darwin was never in a position to know about become increasingly accentuated by recent work. So science is always a work in progress. It's always undergoing revision. But I think that when we step back, we can always discern kind of stable trends in that kind of work all the same.
We like to think about scientists working in a vacuum, or at the very least leaving everything else in the world outside the lab door. Of course, we know this isn't possible. Your book made me think for the first time about the way that a scientist like Darwin was influenced by the world that he inhabited, and specifically by his immersion in capitalism.
Yeah, I think that's right. So this was noted very, very early on by some of Darwin's own contemporaries. So people like Karl Marx pointed out even at the time that Darwin seemed to view the natural world as this gigantic marketplace, a gigantic marketplace featuring things like the opening up of new markets as species become increasingly diverse, also increasing division of labor and specialization. So Marx basically said himself, and I think Marx is right about this, Marx basically said Darwin kind of viewed the natural world through the lens of a Victorian capitalist, basically. Now, as I say, I think Marx is right about that. You see quite often that Darwin uses arguments about the natural world, which are kind of lifted almost from economic arguments. Why is it that species become increasingly diverse over time? Answer: for the same reason that competition in a marketplace eventually drives different producers into more and more diversified economic niches. That's basically the kind of argument that Darwin uses. So he's bringing his own experience as a very successful investor, because after all, Darwin made a lot more money from his own investments than he ever did from his books. Darwin was a very, very rich person. Darwin's kind of bringing his own experiences as an investor to his scientific theorizing. And I think it's really important to say that although Darwin's theorizing, I think, is colored by his political and economic experiences, I don't think that means there's anything wrong with Darwin's work. I think that in some ways you can see Darwin's political experiences as allowing him to notice features of the organic world that otherwise maybe previous theorists wouldn't have spotted.
Let's jump back on the phones now. We have Scott on the line in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I was wondering, you were just talking about scientific realism and anti-realism, and I was wondering whether you put Thomas Kuhn in which camp you would put Thomas Kuhn, which was he?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to easily pigeonhole Kuhn here. He's certainly not a straightforward scientific realist. So we haven't mentioned Thomas Kuhn yet during this discussion, but just by way of background, Kuhn is, I guess, in many ways, after Karl Popper, one of the other real giants of 20th century philosophy of science. Kuhn, of course, spent his life working in the US. The reason why it's very, very difficult to say that Kuhn is a scientific realist is because the general idea that tends to characterize a lot of scientific realists is the notion that although science isn't finished, it's nonetheless on an inexorable path towards the truth. over time science converges on some kind of stable, agreed upon truth about the universe. And for various reasons, Kuhn himself was really, really skeptical about that way of thinking about scientific progress. Kuhn did think, a lot of people think that Kuhn denied that science made progress. Kuhn didn't. Kuhn thought science made progress, but he didn't like this notion of science converging on one single set of truths about the universe. Instead, Kuhn thought that the universe itself was something like a moving target. He thought that there was no stable object for science to investigate that was independent of the theories that we construct about that universe. And so, roughly speaking, what that meant was that Kuhn thought that as our theorizing about the universe changes, so the universe itself changes too. And because of that, we're always chasing a kind of moving target. There's no stable reality for science to ever capture. It's a fairly radical view. It's a fairly exotic view, I think. And it also, I think, shows that there's no way that we can describe Kuhn as a scientific realist in any standard sense of that term.
We're speaking this hour with Tim Lewins. He's professor of philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Clare College. He has a new book out called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with philosophy professor Tim Lewins of the University of Cambridge. His new book is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tim, there are lots of people who think that we should apply science to the decisions we make about public policy. Of course, there are lots of apparently contradictory conclusions reached by scientists. So what do we do with that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we need to listen to the best scientific evidence. There are a whole bunch of very, very important decisions that governments face about whether to make new reproductive technologies legal, for example. And we're hearing a lot of this kind of thing at the moment, whether to make new technologies for the extraction and use of natural resources available, all of those kinds of things. And of course, it would be crazy to think that we should proceed without taking any note of scientific advice. At the same time, though, I think it's naive to think that scientific advice is somehow factually untainted by evaluative assumptions. And in fact, I don't think science can even be or should even be untainted by those kinds of assumptions. Because if you think about it, a group, you know, trying to formulate a report on climate change, for example, which, you know, maybe will be used by governments. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports have just this kind of role. And suppose they're trying to decide, for just the reasons that you said, right? There's not necessarily widespread agreement among scientists. How are they supposed to decide what scientific evidence they're going to put into their report? Which bits of scientific evidence should they choose to then, so to speak, pass up to people in power who can really act on this kind of advice? It's very, very difficult for them to find anything like a completely neutral editorial policy on this. You might think, well, it's obvious what they should do. They should only use work that's been subjected to the highest standards of peer review. But even then, there's a problem because peer review takes a lot of time. Maybe it turns out that there's some extremely important work that we really need to know about right now, but which hasn't gone through peer review yet. And so then it looks as though maybe the people compiling the report should break their rule. Maybe they should include this piece of information. And this is exactly the kind of thing that happens in work on climate change, for example. There's a real problem about deciding what to include and what not to include. And it's very, very difficult to think of any way in which those kinds of editorial decisions can be made without the people compiling the reports thinking about, well, what kind of mistakes might we make here? How bad would it be if we didn't include this information but we should have had? How bad would it be if we do include this information but it turns out to be mistaken? Now, all of those questions, I think, are fundamentally evaluative questions. So I think that we should be skeptical of the idea, not just that science can, but that science even should try to inform policy in a completely neutral kind of way. I don't think that's possible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now to Andrew in Richardson. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, great show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask about the philosopher Paul Feyerabend, who I'll let the professor explain far more articulately than I can. But in a nutshell, he said that there is no philosophy of science, that scientists do not use any methodology. They just do whatever they need to do at any one particular time. And I'd like to hear his opinion on that.
Thanks,
Popper. Okay. Yeah, thanks very much. So we've already mentioned Popper and Kuhn, and then Feyerabend in some ways often comes in as a kind of number three after those guys that we've already mentioned. Feyerabend is notorious for his views, so to speak, against method. And Feyerabend tended to preach various forms of what he used to refer to as kind of intellectual anarchy. So he had this kind of anything goes view. Funnily enough, I actually think there's quite a lot in Feyerabend's ideas. And there are a number of different ways in which you can appreciate this, I think. So the first thing to say is, who knows what tools are going to turn out to be useful for investigating the world around us? The question of what the right scientific tool is going to depend on what the phenomena are that we're trying to investigate. If you want to know how to understand how people react to a drug, then it's really useful to use something like a clinical trial. If you want to understand the fundamental structure of a crystal, then instead you might need to use X-rays. We don't know in advance what the right tools are going to be. So it's probably a bad idea to make any really strong methodological prescription. Instead, scientists need to just try out loads and loads of things and figure out what works. So that already gives us one reason for thinking that it's maybe unlikely that there's going to be a single methodological prescription for how we should go about finding things out about the universe. There's another way, I think, to get across some of Feyerabend's ideas.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. It sounded as though I just disappeared there. So there's another way of making sense of some of Feyerabend's ideas, which is to focus on what happens when a scientific theory is newly born. So most scientific theories, when they're first formulated, are born into extremely hostile evidential environments. Nobody believes them. Everybody thinks the evidence is stacked against them. And in those embryonic forms, it's often really important for the scientist behind the theory to just be really, really stubborn and insist that somehow or another, they're going to work things out. They're going to put this theory together. They're going to develop it so that over time, you wait, you'll just see that it can handle all of this horrible, problematic evidence that my adversaries think are all kind of stacked against it. Now, that's another way of suggesting that often a certain kind of obstinacy is really important if science is going to make progress. And so how are we going to say in advance whether it's best for a scientist to be pig-headed and obstinate, or whether instead it's best for a scientist to be open-minded? Well, that's anybody's guess. It looks as though different blends of those different attitudes are going to be really important. And it's, I mean, those are some of the considerations, I think, that help to explain why it is that Feyerabend really thought it was a fool's errand to try to give any kind of detailed prescription of what scientific method should be. Scientists can just use whatever resources they can find to hand and whatever seems to work.
Does an acknowledgement of the importance of science in public life require that we presume scientific explanations are always the most complete and valid of a variety of different kinds of explanations for things that we observe?
Well, that's a good question. I think it certainly tends to assume that science is at least the best resource that we have available at the moment. Of course, that doesn't mean that it couldn't be overturned in various kinds of ways. It's also really important, I think, to understand that if you want to use science for making sort of policy, if you want to use science to inform deliberation about new technologies, you need the scientific evidence, but the scientific evidence can't tell you everything all by itself. And there are a whole bunch of good examples here. So actually today in the US, there's been a report just issued looking at whether or not a series of technologies that would help women who have so-called mitochondrial disease have healthy children free of those mitochondrial diseases. And this technology involves very kind of novel experimental interventions into reproductive processes. Now, of course, it's absolutely essential that deliberation about that technology is informed by the best science. But it's also very important that when we think about whether those technologies should be introduced, that we're also thinking about what kind of value these new technologies can bring. What's the value, for example, of having children that are genetically related to us when maybe instead we could adopt, or maybe we could use donor eggs from someone who's not related to us? How are we going to decide whether or not the child born from these technologies is going to have a good life free from stigma? Because in the case of the particular technologies I've just mentioned, it's a very, very fancy form of IVF that actually involves three different genetic contributors. And that's one of the reasons why these technologies are sometimes described as three-parent baby technologies. So we've always got to be thinking about broader social implications, broader evaluative implications, at the same time as we're getting the absolute best scientific advice as well.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Henry on the line in Dallas. Hello, Henry.
Hello. Thanks for letting me ask this speculative question of the professor. We have the benefit of thousands of years of scientific thought. I'd like to analogize to a human. Is science today the age of a babe, an adult, an old man? I'm 88 myself. I know all too well what that means for the human life. How old is science?
Oh, wow. I do you know what? I'd love to be able to answer that question, but I think for me to do that would demand having some kind of crystal ball that I don't have. It would be great if we philosophers could somehow press fast forward on the scientific research process and tell you what things are going to be like in 100 years, or what things are going to be like in 200 years or 300 years. I think if I were going to be able to answer your question, I'd need to already know how far science will have changed at various stages in the future. And that's the only way in which I could explain to you, I think, how those future scientists will look back on what we've done and whether they'll think of ourselves as you know, six-year-olds who are doing a pretty good job learning how to construct sentences for the first time, or whether they'll think of ourselves as undergraduates who are doing really impressive first scientific research projects, or whether instead they'll think of us as, you know, worthy of Nobel Prizes at a universal scale. I just can't tell you the answer to that question, because I think, unfortunately, that would demand a kind of clairvoyance. I do think that future scientists will look back on what we're doing and see that we are, in some sense or another, doing work that is along the right lines in their own eyes. But they might have a fairly patronizing attitude, I think, towards the progress that we've made so far.
In terms of what science can't do for us, you include in the book a little fable about a scientist named Mary who has confined her whole life to a black and white environment. Can you tell us about her?
Oh, yeah, sure. So this is one of the best known philosophical thought experiments of the past, I guess, the past 50 years or so. And we owe it to a very, very highly respected Australian philosopher called Frank Jackson. Jackson asks us to imagine this brilliant scientist called Mary. Mary knows everything there is to know about the physics of surfaces. She knows everything there is to know about the neuroscience of color vision. She knows everything there is to know about the physiology of the eye and so forth. She knows all of this stuff about how humans perceive color. But Mary herself has been locked up for all of her life in a black and white room. She only ever wears black and white clothes. She doesn't have access to a mirror, so she can't see the color of her own eyes. She's only ever seen black and white things. And yet she knows all the facts there are to know, all the scientific facts there are to know about color and color perception. And then, according to Jackson's thought experiment, we imagine that one day, finally, Mary opens the door of her black and white house and is confronted for the first time by a bright red double-decker London bus. And she says to herself, "Ah, I never knew what red was like, but now I do." Now, Jackson's idea is, or rather was, because Jackson's changed his mind somewhat about exactly what this shows, but Jackson's idea was that, well, by hypothesis, we said that Mary knew all the scientific facts, but also Mary learns something new when she leaves her room. She learns what it's like to see red. So then it sounds as though there must be something that Mary now knows that she didn't know. She must have learned something new. And if she's learned something new, but before that she learned all the scientific facts, then it must be that there are some facts, some pieces of information that just aren't scientific at all, that we need to get access to in some other kind of way. So Jackson thought this was an argument against the idea that ultimately all the facts there are to know are just scientific facts. There must be some other kinds of facts in addition to this.
Tim Lewins is professor of philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Clare College. His new book is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. Tim, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, and thanks to your callers who've really come up with some fantastic questions.
Indeed. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Alex Smith, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.